Mr. Brown?
Could you tell me the gas oil ratio, the crude bus to pay oil, and also is the government going to let you produce oil without conservation of the gas?
If I knew the gas oil ratio at one time, but I wouldn't feel free to give that information out if I could remember it, and I don't remember it.
That's fairly safe. Any other questions? I think, thank you very much. I think we will have one more paper and then break for coffee. And our next presentation is by Homer Burrell, the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Department of Natural Resources in Anchorage, and his subject is the role of state agencies in petroleum exploration and development. Mr. Burrell, would you like to talk to me here?
Sure, that'd be fine. Dr. Reed, fellow speakers, ladies and gentlemen, as Dr. Reed said, the topic is the role of state agencies in petroleum exploration and development in the North. The information gathered for this paper was gathered from discussions with representatives of the other state agencies. However, the conclusions are all my own. The recent discoveries of oil and gas in the Arctic North Slope of Alaska have extended to the government and the people of Alaska the promise of untold wealth. They have also imposed new and expanded responsibilities upon many state agencies, some of which differ in both nature and magnitude from those previously faced in the oil and gas fields of the Cook Inlet area and from those faced by state agencies in other states. Notwithstanding such differences, Alaska has certain advantages. One, ownership of the oil and gas resources underlying the North Slope is apparently virtually 100% state or federal, and the surface ownership is the same. Two, Alaska has 2 or 3 years before production will commence in any significant quantities, although exploratory and development operations are currently proceeding at a feverish pace. And three, Alaska has the benefit of the other states' many years of experience in establishing guidelines for the encouragement, the regulation, and taxation of the oil and gas industry. It is hoped that we in state government will be wise enough to maximize the benefits of these advantages, to use the limited time remaining to carefully consider the proper objectives of state government with respect to these newfound petroleum resources, and to accept, reject, and modify policies of other states as necessary, so that these resources will be wisely developed for the benefit of all the people of Alaska and of the United States, with proper consideration of the diverse interests and values affected by such development. Petroleum exploration and development in the North Slope poses the following questions to the people of Alaska. One, what are the state's objectives and what should be the role of state agencies in attaining these objectives? Two, are the various state agencies ensuring that these objectives are met? And if not, why not? Three, what can be done to better define these objectives and to assist the various state agencies in the attainment thereof? Notwithstanding its relative isolation, the Arctic North Slope of Alaska is fully a part of Alaska and is therefore subject to the same laws and regulations as are the more populated parts of the state. The absence of any significant population centers and enterprises has merely to date minimized the necessity for exercise of these laws and regulations. State troopers, judges, revenue officials, labor enforcement officials, and others have had little occasion to visit the vast uninhabited areas of the North Slope. Indeed, prior to the oil and gas activity, few state officials other than representatives of the Departments of Fish and Game and Natural Resources had any occasion to enter the area outside the few villages and towns. The recent influx of workers and supplies, together with activities directly and indirectly supporting the oil and gas operations, have changed this. Recent reports indicate that there are approximately 27 drilling rigs on or en route to the North Slope, all but 6 of which are currently drilling. In addition, millions of tons of supplies for the coming winter are being unloaded from barges at various places from Point Barrow east to Prudhoe Bay, and there are at least 10 geophysical crews active, plus an unknown number of geological field parties. Permanent camps and topping plants to produce fuel from oil are also under construction, plus roads and airfields. Telephone communication systems are also being established, and there's a great influx of airplane traffic hauling personnel and supplies. Oil and gas production from the North Slope of Alaska constitutes use of a non-renewable resource. This does not, as some few have suggested, mean that such production should be prohibited. It does, however, suggest that regulatory criteria should differ from those applicable to renewable resources, primarily in its concern for the price which a state receives for its share of the oil and gas produced, including taxes thereon, and in its concern with the prevention of waste. The price which a state will receive for its royalty share of production is subject to, as yet undefined, federal government policies with respect to import quotas, the depletion allowance granted the oil and gas and other extractive industries, the expensing of intangible drilling costs, the native claims, and the Jones Act, all of which are critical to the determination of value of North Slope oil and gas. No doubt the apparent political stability of other oil-producing areas of the world will have a bearing on the decisions of the federal government in some of these areas. A decision is required, however, as production from the other major oil-producing states of the United States has either leveled off or declined to such a point that the increasing consumer demand for hydrocarbon energy within the United States will soon require either Alaskan oil or increased imports of foreign oil. Oil and gas revenue to the state includes taxes as well as royalty, plus a great deal of indirect revenue. The use of all such revenue by the state is a critical policy matter, one which demands of both the executive and legislative branches of state government the very highest statesmanship and sophisticated know-how. The same qualities are required to determine the amount of royalty and taxes which the oil and gas industry should pay to the state. Everybody agrees that the industry should pay a fair amount. The problem lies in determining what is fair, and both the executive and legislative branches of state government are currently reviewing and considering this problem. It is hoped that somewhere along the way these two branches will coordinate their efforts rather than accept the advice of different experts, as the writer knows of no such expert qualified to serve as an advisor who is without personal predilections as to oil policy, arising, naturally enough, out of his previous experience from whence arose his expert status. It is obvious to all that too little taxation or too small a royalty is adverse to the interests of the people of Alaska. What is not so obvious is that too much of either is likewise adverse. Alaska's royalty and taxes on oil and gas are generally based on wellhead price. The staff of the President's Task Force on Oil Imports Control recently concluded that North Slope Oil could sell at a wellhead price of 36 cents per barrel, thereby returning the producer some 15% on his investment and be competitive in world markets at that wellhead price. This conclusion has been vehemently denied by one of the largest lessees in the Prudhoe Bay area. It is worthwhile noting that Alaska's royalty and taxes on oil produced from the Cook Inlet area is based on oil with a wellhead price of some 7 to 9 times that 36 cent figure. The latter of these two primary criteria, the prevention of waste, includes the avoidance of unnecessary flaring of gas which may be produced along with the oil. Such gas can, although at considerable expense, be either injected into the reservoir or transported to market via pipelines. The state's other objectives include safety of drilling, producing and transportation operations, minimal disturbance of the environment as a result of such operations, and the employment policies of the oil companies which may develop the resources of the slope. Personal safety of workers on the North Slope seems to be the concurrent responsibility of the Departments of Labor, Health and Welfare, and Natural Resources. The Safety Division of the Department of Labor is concerned with various safety codes and sanitation and housing, and division inspectors have been active on the North Slope. The Department of Health and Welfare is responsible for sanitation and for engineering, water and waste disposal systems, air pollution and insect and rodent control, housing and occupational health and plumbing requirements. In addition, the Department of Fish and Game has imposed requirements with respect to the disposal of waste so as to avoid contamination of streams. The Division of Oil and Gas of the Department of Natural Resources is responsible for the proper operation of drilling equipment and production facilities and frequently sends representatives to the North Slope to check such operations. There is an obvious overlap of responsibility between these departments, and steps are currently being taken by Governor Miller's Oil Impact Task Force to clarify responsibilities and authorities in these areas. Reacting to criticism by legislators and others, the Department of Labor has attempted to encourage the oil companies and their contractors to employ Alaskan residents to the exclusion of others in their operations. Even assuming that legislation introduced to accomplish this purpose is constitutional, one wonders why the oil industry is singled out for this type of legislation when at the same time timber is being cut on state land by wholly non-resident crews and an inspection of license plates around any subdivision or most subdivisions or other construction projects reveals that the vast majority of license plates are out of state. Like the timber companies and construction companies or builders, the oil companies would prefer to employ qualified Alaskan residents, if for no other reason than to save the $5,000 to $10,000 it costs to move a family in. We have heard a great deal lately about the empty fuel barrels in the North Slope. Although most have been there many years and a large percentage of them were left there by the U.S. Navy, they are still there, notwithstanding the efforts of many of the oil companies to police their leases by picking up and stacking these barrels, and they are an eyesore. Since the Department of Commerce regulates and certifies the air carriers providing transportation for personnel and supplies to the North Slope, perhaps as a condition of certification, it could require the air carriers to backhaul the empty barrels at cost if the aircraft would otherwise return empty. The Department of Fish and Game has long had representatives active on the North Slope. Officials of this department take a semi-annual census of the caribou and report the composition of the herds. Department representatives have recently been attempting to determine the kinds and quantities of fish in the rivers and streams of the North Slope and have taken over 400 Arctic char, grayling, and sheafish from the major rivers this summer. Representatives of the department advise they have not been able to verify the presence of trout or salmon north of the Brooks Range. The Department of Fish and Game has sought to regulate the activities of the oil companies on the North Slope so as to minimize disturbance to the environment, which might adversely affect the wildlife population of the area. Notwithstanding irresponsible statements that, quote, the oil companies have ruined the North Slope, unquote, responsible personnel of the department report no damage to fish or animal population as a result of the oil operations. The department's primary concern, insofar as the oil operations are concerned, is with the long-range effects of removal of the tundra for roads, drill sites, airfields, and other purposes, as well as the avoidance of water pollution and the removal of trash and garbage. With the exception of water pollution, none of the foregoing are known to have an adverse effect upon wildlife, although torn up tundra and trash are certainly aesthetically unacceptable. I would add that the unnecessary destruction of trees and ground cover and the accumulation of trash are unacceptable anywhere, including in and around new subdivisions and other construction projects and along our rivers and roads, whether perpetrated by builders, government agencies, or the general public. As a member of a conservation group, it is my hope that such groups will address themselves to these deplorable practices in the areas in which they live with the same energy and concern as they exhibit concerning the North Slope. In general, the Division of Lands of the Department of Natural Resources functions as a guardian or overseer of state lands, at least to the extent that specific functions are not otherwise assigned to other agencies. Thus, it is the Division of Lands' responsibility to authorize the use of state land, whether for construction of a road or runway, or for mining, the drilling of wells, or removal of gravel. It is also the Division of Lands' responsibility to see that the terms of its lease or permit for the above purposes are being complied with. New surface use regulations are in the process of being promulgated by that division, and they will impose restrictions on the use of certain vehicles and on certain operations, especially in the vicinity of streams or in other areas where such operations or vehicles pose an unusual risk of harm to the environment. These regulations will apply equally to hunters, miners, geophysical companies, oil companies, and anybody else desiring to use state land. In order for the division to properly fulfill its duties as guardian of the public lands, it needs additional qualified personnel and adequate funding to permit the necessary inspection trips. The foregoing has called attention to some gaps and overlaps in the authority of state agencies and has indicated the steps currently being taken to eliminate these problems. Certain proposals of legislators and others have been criticized as unrealistic or discriminatory. It is not, however, intended to suggest that proposals or suggestions are not welcome or indeed sorely needed. We in state government are dealing with potential operations of great magnitude, operations that will permanently change the nature of life in Alaska. This change must, overall, be for the better, and it is the duty of all those in state government to do their best to make wise decisions in order that the petroleum resources are properly developed. This responsibility rests with both the executive and legislative branches of government. In order to make these decisions, the assistance and advice of all concerned groups and individuals is solicited. Particularly valuable are the studies being carried out by educational institutions such as the University of Alaska, by federal agencies, and by oil companies currently active on the North Slope. Advisory bodies such as the North Commission are invaluable. We need the expertise of the dedicated conservationists who are familiar with the ecology of the area and of those social scientists who can best measure the impact of the development upon the people of the area. We need the advice of financial and tax experts, of agriculturalists and biologists. We need the advice and constructive suggestions of all these people and organizations and of many more. Furthermore, the legislators, and ultimately the people of the state, must decide the relative values of the diverse interests which may be affected. The maintenance and preservation of those given priority must then be assigned to the appropriate state agencies, which must then be adequately staffed and funded to enable them to carry out their assignments. It is hoped and believed that conferences such as this will provide the forum for exchange of ideas and will result in eventual wise decisions. Democracy cannot exist in the dark, and this conference is a place of light. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burrell. Would you just stay here at the head for a moment till you have outlined some of the relatively new and expanded responsibilities of this relatively new state. And if I read you right, you feel that in general the state is facing up to these responsibilities pretty well.
I think they are.
You did not describe another group of relationships between the state and the federal government that I would like to have heard discussed, although it was not quite within your subject. Are there questions or comments, sir?
Well, I wonder if the state has made any estimate as to what the wellhead price should be.
Let me put it this way. The Governor Miller's Oil Task Force Impact Committee has designated a subcommittee of three people, revenue, oil and gas, and law, to work on that project right now. It is currently being worked on.
Any other comments? State seems to be in good hands. We will recess for a few minutes to have coffee, which I believe you'll find just outside the door in the hallway there. The next paper is by a man with whom I share some other responsibilities and who I have known for a long time, Professor M.R. Holter, of the Infrared and Optics Laboratory of the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. And Mike has changed the title of his paper just a little bit, and he would rather have it called Remote Sensing Pertinent to Alaskan, Arctic, and Antarctic Exploration. Mike?
Thank you, John. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, if there are any of you who are a little bit uncertain about what remote sensing means or is, be assured you have lots of company. it's a coined word, a recent one, does not yet have any very precise, generally agreed upon definition. So in just a moment, I will give you my definition, and in that context, I'll talk about some results. The results I will show are the result of many people's work and sponsorship support from many organizations, the Arctic Institute, the Geological Survey, NSF, Naval Oceanographic Office. In the interest of time, I will not indicate specifically the support on each of the results. Well, can you all hear me from up here? Let's take a look at the first slide, please. There is some amount of prevailing opinion that remote sensing consists merely in having a few new magic eyeballs, infrared, radar, and a few things like that. If that's all there were to it, I don't think it would be very interesting and represent a very great increase in capability. I think, in my view at any rate, remote sensing is the synergistic effect of employing jointly in some proper fashion a number of more or less modern techniques. The net result is quite clearly a capability significantly greater than the simple sum of the individual capabilities. We of course do have some new sensors. Knowledge of the things on the surface that we're going to use, all the modern computers, analog and digital, information processing theory in particular, pattern recognition, other aspects of handling data processing, navigation and communications technology, vehicles, some more or less new, some not quite so new, and not the least of the component technologies here is what we've learned essentially since World War II about how to design and optimize the performance of large information generating and handling systems. When one employs those in concert, I think the resultant capability can be a very large step forward. Now, at the present time, no system like that exists. Some parts of it do. So what I want to do this afternoon is go very rapidly through a number of results, none of which I will discuss in any great detail, in hopes of giving you a panoramic view, if you will, of some of the kinds of information that can be made available in a very few years will result in aerial survey systems which will do much more than we can do at the present time. I'll show, if time permits, six groups of slides, types of results. The first group will be concerned with wavelength-dependent effects, color in an expanded sense, if you will, and the very first result, a selection of four slides, will show the result of having integrated some of the new sensors with some of the knowledge of things on the surface with data processing and automatic pattern recognition techniques. So let's take a look at the next slide, please. This is simply a panchromatic photograph of an agricultural area in California. As a matter of fact, there are only four major types of materials. We have three fields over here of green but relatively mature rice, 18 inches high. We have a number of fields here with much younger rice, perhaps 6 inches high. Two safflower fields here, one here, then some bare earth, and some roads and irrigation ditches and so on. It's pretty apparent that it's at best a very difficult job to identify the materials from the panchromatic photography or from visual air photography. One of the things that's been going on in remote sensing is the devising of a sensor which, if you will, combines a picture-making sensor with a spectrometer. And specifically, one can view a scene such as this, which is 7 miles long and half a mile wide. It takes about 3 minutes in an aircraft to generate that sort of data. Can view that area in 18 different wavelength bands. It'll take two slides to show that. Could we look at the next slide, please? It shows half of those 18 bands. The next slide, please. For wavelength, this is an ultraviolet wavelength here. The wavelengths are indicated on the right. The blue end of the visible getting successively longer. This is about the green in the visible, getting a little bit into the yellow down here. You can see that the contrasts tend to be somewhat different here, and perhaps in the next slide, please. Our projection has walked out, I guess. Here we have the red end of the visible. That is probably the last wavelength that's available in the visible. Then we have reflective infrared here, and thermal infrared down at the bottom here. Well, there's no point in dwelling on this. Normally, the basic information is recorded electronically. I've just printed the individual pictures here from the 18 bands. The proper or the most profitable way to use it is to process it automatically in a computer rather than printing out the individual bands. The next slide shows what one can do with automatic recognition of the, could I have the next slide, please? Recognition of the materials untouched by human hand, if you will. To evaluate the content of those 18 bands, 18 pictures, manually in the normal manner of human photo interpretation is a very time-consuming job. This sort of recognition can be done essentially at the same rate that the aircraft flew and generated the information. And the colors here are merely arbitrarily assigned to the decisions of the computer. The computer decided this was the 18-inch high rice, the blue was the very young rice, the green the safflower, and the black the bare earth. So we're getting to the point where we can do fairly well, I think, at automatically recognizing materials. So this is an intriguing possibility. Another sort of an example, the next one, of wavelength-dependent effects. This is a panchromatic photograph of all that immoral oil off of Santa Barbara. We were asked by the Geologic Survey whether or not we could detect the oil and furthermore differentiate it from the kelp. The treatment is different in the two cases, I presume. So the next slide will show the oil in the very near reflective infrared. The oil doesn't show up. The drilling rig is here. This is, I believe, some of the detergent or whatever dispersing material they were spreading around. In the ultraviolet, the oil shows up very bright compared to the surrounding water. Remember that sequence. The oil is not markedly different from the water in the near infrared. It is brighter in the ultraviolet than the water. The next slide shows the kelp. Now, in the infrared, the kelp does show up brighter than the surrounding water. In the, this dark streak here, I hope you can see it, is the kelp in the ultraviolet. So the kelp is dark in this band in the ultraviolet, whereas the oil was bright. What that means is that it's easy, it's a trivial job to differentiate between the oil and the kelp if one uses this pair of bands, one in the reflective infrared, one in the ultraviolet. So that turns out to be one of the few cases where it's an easy job. The next next slide, please, shows another wavelength-dependent effect, and we're
having all sorts of problems here. Could we slide these tables?
Yeah, if we could move that. Come on, please. That help?
Well, no, that helps. Very good. Is water depth penetration as a function of wavelength? In the ultraviolet here, one can see only the subsurface features very close to the surface because the ultraviolet is scattered by the water. As one goes longer in wavelength into the visible, the best band is here, rather the deepest penetration is here in the green-yellow part of the spectrum. As one goes to longer wavelengths, getting into the orange and the red, there is absorption in the water, and one once again sees only subsurface features here, which are closer to the surface. And of course, in the very, very near infrared, the water completely absorbs all the radiation. But one can level slice, if you will, subsurface features by selection of wavelength. Well, those are a few wavelength-dependent effects one can get by doing various things with remote sensors. The next group of slides will show thermal effects. The next slide you may have seen, it's not a very recent one. This is Kilauea Volcano in the top of panchromatic photography, the main fire pit here. There is no glowing lava. It's all hardened, perhaps up to 6 inches thick. Below is a thermal infrared picture. Clearly one can see much geothermal activity. Perhaps more interesting is the next slide, which is a time-lapse pair in the thermal infrared. The main fire pit is over here. I don't want to look at that at the moment. This one was made in January. This one was made 1 month later in February. In January, in the rift zone extending down from the fire pit, there's only very minimal indication of geothermal activity right here. 1 month later, obviously something has changed considerably. They tell me that the people there watched that area closely, and a few months later, molten material did come to the surface, which is a little bit intriguing. We may have some ability to do some amount of prediction of effects here. The next one is a thermal effect in water. Could be applicable to water pollution. In this case, it was not water pollution we were concerned with. This is in the Tennessee Valley Authority system, just below Norris Dam, 20 miles below the dam. And infrared, both infrared pictures, time-lapse pictures again, in this case 23 hours apart. The earlier one here, the later one here. This is a power plant here. The reason this looks dark is that a skimmer has skimmed the warmer water off the surface before entry into the power plant. I should remark that in all of the infrared pictures I will show here, with one exception, the lighter tones represent more radiant power, higher apparent temperatures. So the darker things look cool here. Well, at the time this flight was made on one day, 20 miles upstream, the gates on Norris Dam were opened a little bit to let a slug of cold water into the river. About 23 hours later, you see that slug of cold water has progressed down here, and with, to me at any rate, surprisingly little mixing at the interface here. That slug of cold water has been traveling through the river for 23 hours. Well, this has all sorts of implications with regard to pollution, stream flow, and so on. The next one is the last of the thermal effects. Now, the colors here are merely a coding of the apparent temperature in the 8 to 14 micron band. This is in the vicinity of Bartow, Tampa, Florida, and it's a very intriguing effect. There's karst topography down there. There are voids under the surface, and when the water drains out of them, subsidence frequently occurs, swallowing houses and all sorts of things. This is a known sinkhole, and there appears to be every evidence that when we have somewhat circular annuli of temperatures of different levels indicated by the different colors here, that those are associated with the sinkholes. Now, this picture was made last fall, and at that time, there was no indication on the surface of any subsidence here or here. In approximately February or March of this year, subsidence did begin to occur, which is intriguing. We have some ability to sense something going on underneath the surface. In a number of other cases, drilling was done where we saw these patterns in the imagery, and voids were found up to, I think, at least 65 feet below the surface of the earth. Well, the next sequence are a number of special effects. The next slide, please. This is a time progression, at least in the infrared. There's much to be learned from the diurnal cycles, behavior over diurnal cycles. This is Mud Lake Bog in the vicinity of Ann Arbor, one of our dying lakes. The center right area is freestanding water. There's bog mat around the edges, and around that some grassy and wooded terrain. I'll call attention to only one feature of the sequence here. This is in the thermal infrared again, the emitted region, 4.5 to 5.5 microns. It's quite typical with water that prior to dawn, the water appears to be warmer than the surrounding terrain because of its high heat capacity. After the sun comes up, the temperature of the water is changing very little. We have changed the gain of the instrument, however, to get some detail in the terrain. The terrain is warming up relative to the water, and at about 11 o'clock in the morning, the water having changed temperature fairly very little, the terrain has become much warmer than the water. Now, water is an unusual material both in the infrared and the radar. It has a much higher heat capacity than most other things in the world. It also has a much higher dielectric constant of about 80, whereas most things in the world are 4 or 5. So we'll find all throughout those techniques that wherever there's water, one can expect some distinctive features. Now, in the next slide, let's take a look at this Mud Lake Bog in a seasonal comparison. This is in the same wavelength band. The time of day, the part of the diurnal cycle, is just before dawn. This is June, the way we would expect it, September. All of a sudden in January, he looks different, and it destroyed our preconceived notions. Well, as a matter of fact, he isn't water. It's ice in January. And as far as its reflection and emission are concerned, ice is a different material than water. But it illustrates that there are, if you will, signatures distributed around seasonal cycles. The next slide shows another special effect. This is just photography, but at two different polarizations. A small lake in the spring near Ann Arbor with some late spring ice here, wooded terrain around, and one can see that the relative contrast of the water to the terrain and the water to the ice is different in the polarizations. Even more interesting, the two forest stands here look different in contrast with that polarization. They do not with that polarization. So there are effects, possibly distinctive effects with regard to materials in polarization that one can capitalize on. The next special effect is penetration of fog. And there are many parts in the world of the world where one would like to do remote sensing, but there are low-lying fogs. This is an ultraviolet picture. One sees only the top of the light ground fog present. This is a very near infrared picture. We still see only the top of the ground fog. The table's a little bit in the way here, but in this one we are penetrating the ground fog, and I guess we can you slide that over to the right just a little bit? One can see through the fog to the end of Portage Lake here with some roads off the lake and so on. So at longer wavelengths than approximately 4 microns, one can see through light ground fogs, not through heavy fogs or clouds. If one wants to look through bona fide clouds or pea soup fogs, he must go to radar wavelengths. The next slide, please. Could we slide the whole picture to the to your right, please? The other way. That way. Very good, thank you. Could you slide it a little more in that direction, please? Let's leave the titles off. I know what the titles are. Let's get the pictures on the... Thank you. Here's another effect. There are many cases where one wishes to expose photography properly, simultaneously in shade and in sunlight. If he wants to look under trees or through cloud shadows, in the ultraviolet one can do this. The instrument, this is an ultraviolet picture on the top. This is a cloud shadow here, but because of the high scattering at that wavelength, one sees in the cloud shadow almost as well as he does in the direct sunlight. Down here at the 1 micron region, just slightly outside of the visible, the clouds are inky black. So there are some, particularly for foresters, I suspect, some interesting effects there. The next one, I keep getting questions. Can we see those caribou herds? Well, here's a partial answer. This is an infrared picture of a barnyard in Michigan. Though what it illustrates is we can detect those cows. We cannot identify them. I don't want to mislead you, but they can be detected. This is a flash photograph made just after the infrared flight, looking in the area indicated with the dark V there, and what we're seeing are those cows around. I think that's the end of the sequence on special effects. The next slide starts a sequence on more purely Arctic problems. Could we slide that back a little bit this way? Are we off the screen over there? Well, very good. This is a panchromatic photograph of sea ice of various sorts. This is an infrared photograph. What one finds with the infrared is that there is a direct correlation between the apparent temperature and the thickness of the ice. The water below is at something like 0 degrees centigrade. The air temperature is usually different. If the air temperature is colder, the degree to which the surface of the ice can approximate the air temperature and not the water is a function of its thickness. Therefore, the dark areas here are much thicker ice. The lighter the area, the higher the temperature, the closer to the water temperature, the thinner the ice, and these very light streaks through here are open leads through the pack. So one can get some indication of ice thickness with the infrared. The next one shows another interesting effect in the Arctic basin. This is a panchromatic photograph. This is an infrared picture. What we're seeing here is the land-water boundary beneath, I don't really know how much snow and ice. Probably not very thick, but at any rate, this is all that's available visually and in the panchromatic photography or color photography. In the infrared, quite clearly one can see the coastline through the cover that's there. The next one is in the vicinity of Point Barrow. I've shown just the blue end of the visible and just outside the red end of the visible. All the pictures in between look alike. The ice and the snow do not have much wavelength structure in the visible. It's only when one gets into the infrared that we see new effects occurring. So I haven't bothered to show the 9 or 10 pictures in between these two wavelengths here. They all look alike. The next one is a panchromatic photograph of the Tuto East weather station just up on the Greenland ice cap on the road out to Camp Century here. This is what one sees with photography and visually. The next slide shows the infrared. And what we're seeing here are all these snow bridge crevasses. And, you know, by accident, somehow Tuto East was built in the middle of the largest concentration of snow bridge crevasses anywhere near it. I'm not aware that they've lost anybody in them. What happens here is that as the barometric pressure changes, the air breathes through, in and out through the snow bridge and changes the temperature of it, and infrared would appear to be probably the preferred method of finding snow bridged crevasses. The next one is in the vicinity of Point Barrow. Can we slide that to the right just a little? Thank you. And it's sort of interesting. This is a panchromatic photograph. I hope you can see these depressed areas, lake beds, another one over here. One can tell a lot of difference between these things. This one apparently is a dry lake bed because in the infrared, it doesn't show up bright. There are a couple of pools of water under the ice here up in this vicinity, but that information is not available at all in the visible. This lake bed here is quite bright. There must be some liquid water underneath the ice, and therefore the surface of the ice is at the snow is at a different temperature than the surrounding terrain. We don't have time to look at it in any detail, but all this little speckling around here and over here is very clear indication of the polygonal terrain up there, which doesn't appear to show very well in the panchromatic. And if one looks closely at these polygonal features, you see a bright, therefore a warm center, and a dark ring around each one at lower temperature. The next one is a glacier in the infrared down in the vicinity of the Ross Ice Shelf. The bright streaks here do correlate well with some features we see on the photography. The dark streaks over here correlate with nothing that we can see on photography. There's something of a lower temperature here. It's only conjecture, but we conjecture that's associated with older ice, and therefore one can learn something about the glaciers in the infrared. He does not get his hands on easily in the visible. The next one is a radar picture of a glacier in Greenland. The upper one, let's see, which is which? The upper one is a radar picture. The lower one is an aerial photograph. I'm probably running too long, so I won't say too much about that. One can see here that dark feature is a lake with ice on the surface. Being a good reflector, it does not give any backscatter to the radar. It looks considerably different down here in the photograph, and there are a number of other differences between those. The next one shows a 15-mile wide stretch of ice up in the Cane Basin. The dark areas here are new ice, very smooth on the surface, not reflecting much directly back at the radar. They represent recently refrozen leads. There is a fairly regular pattern to the leads that have opened up and refrozen here. The radar will not take a picture directly underneath the aircraft. So this is to the left of the aircraft, this is to the right of the aircraft, and we get nothing right under the aircraft. This can possibly be used to deduce something about the forces on the ice. With all these leads here, certainly there are tensile forces tending to pull that part of the pack apart. The next one is a radar picture of icebergs, which show up quite strongly as these bright features here, good reflectors. The next one starts a new sequence, I think. This is sort of old now, but this is an infrared picture made from orbit, a 600-mile orbit, Nimbus 1. One can see with the table in the way here, but here's the boot of Italy with Sicily here, and that shadow of the table sticks right up into the heel of the boot of Italy. This is Sweden, somewhat distorted in the geometry here. Norway, Denmark, the corner of Great Britain. Now this is a negative of the way the meteorologists make their pictures. So the bright spots are warm here. The meteorologists do things differently than everybody. They like their clouds to look white. So the next slide shows another Nimbus picture, and I didn't bother to make the negative. So now this is the one picture in which the bright features are cold rather than hot. The point of this is the Ross Ice Shelf down here in the Antarctica. I hope you can see a little dark spot there, a dark spot there. You probably cannot see that one. Those represent warm features, 10 to 15 degrees above in temperature, above the surrounding area here. I am not sure enough of the geometry here, but I believe that that one is Mount Erebus. It's in about the right position. And the next slide shows, made somewhat later from an aircraft, two infrared pictures of Mount Erebus. Clearly, things are quite warm there. They're made at two different gain settings in the instrument to sort out the hotter things from the cooler things. That little spot right there is molten lava in the middle of the fire pit. Well, this is just a long collection of isolated examples. I realize it. I would like very much to have shown you the results from a complete operating system that would find the oil for you or whatever you're interested in. No such system exists or has been tried to date. This is about where we stand in my judgment, and I would hope you would agree, however, that the richness of the technology and the information that one can get is mighty intriguing, and I think we can look forward within fairly short order as we develop these things to finding operationally useful things. Now I have one more slide, has nothing to do with this remote sensing. A picture I ran across a number of years ago, and in case anyone can't guess what that is, the story it goes with goes something like, "And there sat Sam, looking cool and calm, in the heart of the furnace roar. He had a smile as big as a mile, and he said, 'Please close that door. It's fine in here, but I greatly fear you'll let in the snow and the cold. And since I left Plumtree in Tennessee, it's the first time I've been warm.'"
Thank you, Mike. I imagine the minds of a good many of you were running as mine did. How can some of these techniques be applied to some of the problems that we face in the North today? I expect that maybe the skipper of the Manhattan might be able to use some of these things a few years from now. Are there any questions of Mr. Holder?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to make an announcement. I don't think anything from the Department of Economic Development. And on November 4th to 6th, the department, in co-sponsorship with the Department of Interior, will sponsor a symposium on the use of remote sensing systems. This will be held at Anchorage. The purpose of the symposium will be to demonstrate some of the practicalities of using these remote systems. The objective in mind of hopefully having a program established for resource development, resource management, and resource conservation. And the ultimate objective that we would hope to obtain would be a geophysical survey of Alaska. So an invitation extends to anybody who would like to attend this symposium. I think we have a very high caliber program of people from over the United States and Canada who will be attending this program and presenting material based around the practical aspects of the use of this system.
Thank you. The others? Thank you very much, Mike. Our last paper today, ladies and gentlemen, is on economic models of petroleum exploration. And the speaker is Professor Paul Bradley of the Department of Economics of the University of British Columbia. Professor Bradley, can you live with this upset arrangement?
I would like to get this one
in the line. Yes, okay. Would you like the map down too, or is that all right?
Disrespectful to the state, the map will be fine. I would like to correct one omission that appears in the program notes. Most of this work I've been doing with a colleague at the University of British Columbia, Russell Euler, so that I do wish the paper to be considered as co-authored.
Can't hear too well here.
Is the mic?
Is the mic on?
I think, I didn't realize that. If it's dead, I think I can speak louder.
I think it's on.
Do you have any noise?
Okay. Let me comment very briefly again that I wanted to make the point that I have been doing this work with a colleague, Russell Euler, at the University of British Columbia, and so the paper should be considered as co-authored. My comments must serve as an introduction to this paper, since with the possible exception of a few panel members, none of you have had a chance to read it. And I hope I'm going to be able to entice some of you to eventually read it, because as we point out toward the end of the paper, we're discussing work that can hardly be considered finished, and as a result, your comments and criticism would be most welcome. We're very much in the market for them. The fact that as an economist, I find myself in the company of geologists on this panel is not unfortunate, except perhaps to my ego, as I realize how complicated their problems are. But the work should be interdisciplinary, and I'm quite certain that before we can go any further in specifying economic models of exploration, we're going to have a much closer identification, specification of geologic variables than we have accomplished so far. Two messages came through to me as I listened to the panel yesterday morning. One, which I take out of context, is that the results of exploration activity, which by their nature are unknown, require a flexible system in order to absorb them and react to them. Now, the purpose of the work that I'm going to discuss is to try to establish a framework of analysis which, while it can never hope to tell in advance whether the next few wells of a drilling program are going to discover oil, can at least provide a means of using information we have in order to form expectations as to what the results of future drilling will be. Such expectations are expressed in probabilistic terms. That is, what's the expected amount of oil that will be found by an increment of investment in exploration? What's the dispersion of possible results? That is, what's the likelihood of finding a little bit or the likelihood of not finding very much? Now, the second remark had to do with the relation between mathematical equations, particularly those used by economists, and wisdom. And the allegation was that the length of the equation measured in inches correlated inversely with wisdom, though I'm not quite sure how the speaker measured that. Now, my remarks and the paper itself are pretty well purged of equations, and I'll have to leave it to any readers to judge whether the relation that I suggest in fact applies to this sort of work. In the opening sections of the paper, we indicate what mathematical models are and why they're useful, and we point out that we're particularly interested in probability functions. Now, we'll have to substitute the blackboard for some of the attractive slides we've seen so far, but in Figures 1 and 2, which I've redrawn from the paper, I sketch what I mean by probability function. You'll notice that in Figure 1, we are concerned with the relative frequency of occurrence of different size pools or deposits of mineral. Thus, if you consider the first bar, that suggests that for 100 deposits found, a certain number of them are of that smallest size. The next bar, essentially a histogram, suggests that for the next larger size, in that particular population, there were a larger number present. The diagram below it is much the same thing.